In 2017, a noted children's nonfiction author teamed up with one of the nation's foremost constitutional scholars to address the fact that many of the political issues we struggle with today have their roots in one place, the U.S. Constitution. Their opinion led to the writing of an award-winning book, Fault Lines in the Constitution. Now, after two of the most tumultuous years in this nation's political life, Cynthia Levinson and Sanford Levinson have revisited their work. The revised edition of Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today features two brand new timely chapters, one on presidential pardons and another on the executive power to hire and fire government officials. Again, the name of the book is Fault Lines in the Constitution, and it's a great pleasure to welcome co-author Sanford Levinson to the roundtable this morning. Sandy, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
What brought you to want to tell this story and to update it in such a way?
The quick answer is that my wife is literally a prize-winning author of books for kids, and her editor at Peachtree Publishers had given her father a book that I had written very much for adults called Framed: America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Her father liked it and asked her, is there anything like this for kids? And Kathy said no, which is true. And so Kathy suggested to Cynthia that she and then we work together on a book directed at teenagers, but I'm always very quick to say that it's for readers of all ages. My hope is that the grandparents, parents, aunts and uncles, etc., get hooked on the book as well. But the target audience is, kind of 10 or 11 until 17, and that's the story of the book.
When it comes to these updates and looking at new chapters, what brought you to the necessity to look at this ever-growing document, I assume?
Sure. I think in some very real ways, the Trump presidency is kind of the equivalent of what we often said about banks in 2008, 2009. That is, they were providing stress tests, and we needed to give stress tests for how well they were working. The Trump presidency, for better or for worse, is exposing aspects of the Constitution that I would argue, we argue, were there all along. Many of these go back to 1787, but this particular presidency exposes them more clearly. So the two chapters that we added, and the first edition was just 2 years ago, and it's really quite remarkable that in 2 years we not only updated some of the material, but also addressed these two new topics. One of them is the pardoning power, where literally his very first pardon was of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who had been convicted of contempt of court for violating federal injunctions about his racist policing practices. And then he seriously suggested that he might pardon himself, let alone other associates. And so the pardoning power, which I had written about in Framed, suddenly moved from an esoteric topic to something that was being discussed all over. The second chapter we added is on not only the appointment power, but also the firing power. One of the things that the Trump presidency reveals is the importance, and again, the Trump presidency isn't new on this, it's simply more obvious that we have created a government within the White House that doesn't go through Senate confirmation. And in fact, the Senate can't even subpoena them to testify. So I'm thinking of people like the National Security Advisor, and there are many other people. And as I say, other presidents began this, but it's becoming more and more obvious in the Trump administration. Donald Trump has said that he actually enjoys having a lot of acting heads of agencies who ought to be confirmed by the Senate, but he doesn't bother even making nominations because, as he points out accurately, he has more power over individuals if they don't have to go through the Senate. Then there's the firing power that began with James Comey, who had been confirmed by the Senate, but he was abruptly fired by Donald Trump, and Trump fired Rex Tillerson. He, in effect, pushed out James Mattis, though Mattis resigned more in principle than actually being told you're fired. He clearly fired Jeff Sessions. And this goes back to decisions and debates of 1789, 1790 that are just crystal clear in terms of their importance to the functioning of government in 2019. So I'd say that accounts for the two brand new chapters.
Just the title alone, Fault Lines in the Constitution. Are we seeing the flaws? Are we seeing those fault lines more now than we ever have?
I think so. Part of it is, as I've already suggested, Donald Trump pushing all sorts of envelopes.
Right.
But it's also an important part of my own writing and teaching and what we write in our book, that it's a mistake to view Trump as just coming out of nowhere. That since World War II, especially, presidents of both political parties have pushed the envelope with regard especially to foreign and military policy, but also with regard to domestic policy. Barack Obama pushed the envelope with regard to DACA, the program for young children who've been brought in, either brought in illegally or overstayed visas, which is actually more common than illegal entry. And, I and many other people defended what Obama did, and, partly by saying, well, he'd been delegated this power by congressional statutes. Back in the 1930s, Justice Cardozo from New York had coined the term delegation run riot with regard to Congress basically writing presidents blank checks. And for 80 years, that has described a lot of the modern administrative state. And again, let me say that as a constitutional law professor, I don't see an alternative to wide sweeping delegation, given the complexities of modern government. That being said, one also assumes that presidents will be somewhat restrained in their use of power. But we see with Donald Trump that he's not restrained. We are now in this tariff war with China that he's not behaving unconstitutionally, but what he's doing is using delegated power to the maximum, and Congress is totally unwilling to discipline him. These aspects of, what we would like to think are checks and balances, everything would work out, that Congress will discipline presidents who overreach, well, that's just untrue. And Donald Trump is illustrating in an especially dramatic way the extent to which a strongly willed president can, can push and push, and really is not going to have to fear significant congressional feedback.
Let me just go to some of the new and some of the content here. But you grade the Constitution and it gets a C. You are a professor. That's not a great grade.
You're absolutely right, especially in these days of grade inflation, where any halfway acceptable exam will get a B minus these days.
So my immediate question is, would it have ever graded higher?
That's a terrific question. Because one of the criticisms we, and especially I, get is to say, we've had the Constitution 230 years. It got us through wars. It got us through a depression. It's really a fine Constitution, and you can't really expect anything to be absolutely perfect. Answering your question really requires a lot of deep analysis of the extent, say, with regard to the Civil War, whether the Constitution really in substantial ways caused the Civil War, which I would argue is the case, or with regard to the Depression, whether the Constitution either in its own way helped to cause the Depression or was basically irrelevant. You know, also with World War II, there's no quick way of saying that in World War II, which was billed in a sense as a war between the democracies and dictatorships, and it's World War II more than anything else that led to a culture of what I have called Constitution worship. It became part of the story of World War II that we won not because we had stronger military weapons, not because, if you add especially the efforts of our ally then, the Soviet Union, we had many more people than Germany did and could ultimately prevail. Rather, part of the stock story was that we won because of the Constitution. I doubt that, but in order to resolve that sort of argument, you really have to get deeply into the weeds of historical analysis rather than to use, you know, sound bites. Either, you know, we have this terrific Constitution and it won World War II for us, or to say, as I'm more prone to say, we have this Constitution and thank God it didn't prevent us from winning World War II. But, you know, if we had had the 22nd Amendment then, which says you get only two terms, then FDR couldn't have run for a third term in 1940 and obviously a fourth term in 44. There is recently some revisionist history, even some written by political liberals, who say that maybe you would have been just as well off had Roosevelt not run for re-election. But he ran for re-election and was elected in part because World War II really had already broken out at the time of his re-election. And there was a feeling that he was really the best person for that job. Then in 1944, this was even clearer. So what would it be like if you had a two-term president who really was a fine commander-in-chief and really was an effective international diplomat, who suddenly is told, you can't run again, we have to change horses in midstream. But, you know, he didn't face that. But almost literally the first thing that happened after he died is that Republicans had the political power to propose the 22nd Amendment, and it was ratified in 1951. And for better or worse, presidents are now limited to two terms. A lot of people said that Roosevelt broke the unwritten Constitution, right, which since George Washington had said had been two terms and you're out. But that was obviously wasn't clear in 1940.
My final question to you is one of the just the cultural significance of this book. Heidi Schreck, of course, on Broadway with What the Constitution Means to Me. That play nominated for a Tony and a Pulitzer. And she looks at your book as really the book that fueled all that.
I don't want to go that far. I think it's true that she drew on our book, particularly for the end of the play, which we've seen twice and think is terrific. But what fueled the book is her own experience and, you know, kind of her arc as a feminist. But she, you know, was kind enough to write the world's greatest blurb where she said, I wish every student in America would read this book. The reason she knew of the book, frankly, is that she had attended a presentation at NYU that Cynthia and I gave to about 150 social studies teachers in New York and Connecticut. And we've made the same sort of presentation in Texas, in something sponsored by the Texas State Bar, also to about 150 or 200 social studies teachers. We've gone to the American Library Association convention, and what we know and what we've been told is that a number of teachers are assigning the book, are discussing the book. We made a presentation in Wisconsin where I think something like 350 students had read the book, and then, you know, we Skyped and answered some questions, because the book is distinctive. If there's a cultural significance to our book, I think it's twofold. First of all, it's more critical of the Constitution than most books are. Secondly, what we focus on are the structures of the Constitution, which, unfortunately, most people wrongly believe are kind of dull and boring. What they really want to talk about are the rights provisions, guns, abortion, affirmative action, and the like. Our book really doesn't talk about that. What we talk about are the implications of the House and the Senate, and particularly the Senate. The fact that Wyoming has the same two senators as New York or California, which we think is basically indefensible, and much, much more importantly, has real consequences for the making of public policy. We talk about the president's ability to veto legislation and the immense difficulty of overriding vetoes, which means, in effect, that we have a tricameral system rather than merely a bicameral system. We talk of the immense difficulties in changing the Constitution, unlike state constitutions. Was one of the other distinctive features of our book is that we do a lot of comparisons not only with other national constitutions, but also with state constitutions. So New York, I mean, let me tell you, New York has one of my favorite constitutions in one important respect, because the New York Constitution requires that you get a chance every 20 years as a member of the electorate to vote yea or nay on whether or not to have a new state constitutional convention. Now, you voted against it in 2017, to my regret, but you did have the opportunity to do this, whereas at the national level, we've never had a second constitutional convention. And one of the other ways our book is quite distinctive is that we have a debate in the last chapter between Cynthia and myself, because I want a new constitutional convention at the national level. She, and I always say, like most of my friends, family, and professional colleagues, is really quite horrified by the idea. But we have a real debate. And my hope, and this really would be culturally significant, my hope is that people who read the book, including the teenagers, will start debating these kinds of structural issues with the same intensity as they would debate issues about, say, guns or hate speech or offensive speech or the like. And if they did that, I think it would be, you know, a remarkably healthy development. I'm intrigued by the fact that several of the Democratic candidates for president have used the term structural reform. Right. But quite frankly, they've been quite vague as to what they mean, except for Pete Buttigieg, who has said very, very strongly, we need to get rid of the Electoral College. And he's also hinted, though he hasn't spelled out, that maybe we need to ask other questions about the extent to which we're well served by a constitution drafted in 1787.
Well, the name of the book is Fault Lines in the Constitution, the Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Sandy Levinson, a great pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Again, the name of the book is Fault Lines in the Constitution by Cynthia and Sanford Levinson. The book is out and published by Peachtree. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.